So you're thinking about starting a new website, huh? Maybe you have a new small business idea and want to sell something online. Not porn. I tried that. Went out of business. Turns out there's a lot of competition online for porn. Who knew? Maybe you want to show off your photography, or maybe you want to start that new podcast. GoDaddy is offering an amazing deal. One new or transfer.com for just $1.99 for the first year. That's right, $1.99 for the entire year. You know what you get for $1.99? You get like a 199 pieces of penny candy. They don't exist anymore, but you could get it if you had $1.99. You get my point. Anyway, each new .com comes with a free instant page website and built-in photo album. So what are you waiting for? Get your website started today. Go to GoDaddy.com and enter code Paul at checkout or click on the GoDaddy banner on our website.
One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. This week, very excited to have a very dear friend and legendary radio talk show host, Bob Kavoyan from the Bob and Tom Radio Show. Huge nationally syndicated show with 4 million listeners around the country. I go on the show regularly. The show has been great to comedians over the years. They're awesome, awesome guys there. And just wanted you to learn more about Bob. He started in the business nearly 40 years ago. Great war stories, really funny dude, and talks about miniature naked people. So you can't go wrong with that. And if you want to follow me on tour, you can check me out online at paulmercurio.com, on Facebook, Paul Mercurio, and follow me on Twitter at Paul Mercurio. And July 22nd, mark this down, Monday, July 22nd, I am dropping an interview I did with Sir Paul McCartney. Yes, I am not kidding you. July 22nd, tell your friends, interview I did with Paul McCartney from a little-known band called, I think, The Beatles.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Welcome to the podcast, a very good dear friend and a great human being from the Bob and Tom Show, Mr. Bob Kavoyan. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Paul. An honor to be here.
Thank you.
I'm lying, of course. Yeah. No, it's really been, I guess, it's fun getting to know you over the years, and thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the minute you got to know me and then you met my wife, you said, the one thing that everybody says about my wife, which is
that that's the only reason they talk to you. Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
That's
like,
right.
Paul can come over to the house, but only if he brings the wife.
Bring the missus.
Yes, exactly. For people listening to this, I'm sure a lot of fans, but some may not be, and I want people to know an amazing career, 5 Marconi Awards. Your show, The Bob and Tom Show, which is syndicated nationally, has 4 million listeners in 130 markets. You've been in radio about 35 years and with part of The Bob and Tom Show and partnered with Tom Griswold 34 years. And everyone in the comedy community will tell you this, and I'm sure you know it, but if you don't, I'm going to make you hear it, how generous you are to comedians. You make us look good. And you're one of the last, like, true national outlets that, like, let us come on and do our thing on a regular basis, and you really embrace this. And personally, just been great to me and my family, you know, have me on as a regular all the time and let me go out on tour with the Bob and Tom Comedy Tour around the country, which has been great, brought me to the Bahamas with you. Let me stay at your house several times. Well, okay, you didn't let me stay. I basically just made my.
I know you did stay, but there are things missing. I did want to bring that up. We will, I guess we can do that after the program. So, you know what? We love comedians. We love to laugh. I mean, one of the things that I remember so well, just growing up, was on watching Carson when a comedian was coming on. I was excited. I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to.
Yeah.
To see the comic. So, and then being able to help comedians out, and, you know, a lot of guys come in and the radio guy won't let him talk. You know, say, hey, we got 15 seconds before the song starts. Be funny. And that's no way to treat a comedian. Let them, let their craft be seen. Let it be heard. So.
Yeah. And what you guys do is, like, you remember. Like, you know, like when you first come on the show, for people who don't know, you know, the staff asks for, you know, 4 or 5 bullet points just so that there's some, you know, like every, you know, talk show does, to get some lead-ins to get to know the person. But then you start to develop a personal relationship with the show and with the people, and one thing leads to another, and then that initial thing goes out the window, and it's very much organic, and it's, you know, I may not call in for a month or two, and then it picks right up where we left off with you guys. And that's the art of what you guys do, is it's so conversational and so familial and familiar. Was that something that you sort of developed over time in terms of your persona and as a team on the Bob and Tom show?
I don't think we ever planned any of that. I think we just enjoy your company, and you know, and you as and many other comics, we enjoy their presence. We, like I said, we enjoy laughing, and you people are not only funny, but you're very interesting. You have a lot of great things and a lot of great stories to tell, and you know, I'm a great listener, and I love hearing about it.
Yeah, well, and you're like the fastest ad libber I've ever been on with. You come up with stuff. No, you are. It's like, you know, and it's so funny sometimes because I'm laughing so hard, I'm like out of my own head about what I was going to say because I'm just sitting there laughing at you and what you just said. And you know, you mentioned sort of, you know, making us look good because, you know, you have some of these guys that don't want you to be funnier than them or,
right.
You know, you'll get like... Because I tend to go in and go, look, I'll just say the radio show, you tell me how you want to do it. Some people want you to just do your act and run. Other people want you to be conversational. I said, I'll improv, whatever you want to do. And a lot of times you get like, nah, man, we're loose. We'll just whatever. And then they'll go like, so you work on the Daily Show. What's that like? And then they just like a big fat nothing, you know what I mean? And just leave you hanging. It's just really great the way you guys do this. And I want people to know more about you. I mean, you have really interesting hobbies. You love to fish.
Yep.
You're a big tech gadget kind of guy.
I love gadgets. I think most men do love gadgets. But, you know, if there's something new, I got to look at it. I got to touch it. I got to have it.
What's the latest gadget you got?
Well, let me see. What is the latest gadget? I don't know, probably a 2 terabyte hard drive that I'm trying to fill up with photographs and, you know, just little things like that, stuff that I think make my life easier. But, you know, my wife is showing me a book today. She goes, here, hold this book. And I lifted it up and I was like, geez, this is heavy. And she goes, it's all on my iPad. I don't have to carry this big heavy thing around. I was like, you know what? I love technology.
Exactly.
I really do.
And you played in bands. Music is a big part of your life. You're a great ukulele player, and you write a lot of songs.
That was one of those. I just got self-taught. I got a little tired of playing guitar after a while. I said, you know, I wanted something new that would spark. That I didn't know would spark it, but I just wanted to try something new. And when I picked up the ukulele, you can't play a sad song on the ukulele. It's, I mean, you can't. You can do Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and it's happy. So, you know.
There's a great video of you on YouTube playing Ukulele Baby that people should check out. It's really funny. And you wrote the lyrics for that and everything?
I wrote the music and the lyrics, yeah.
I love your lyrics because they're a little dirty at times, which is fun. It's the good.
Well, I like being, I think it's... Well, sometimes you can't be too clever. You just have to say it, you know. Other times you get the innuendo in there, and it makes people smile.
A little birdie told me your latest hobby, which I want you to talk about, is that you have a terrarium where you put miniature naked people in it.
Wow, that's getting out already, huh? Wow. Here's the best part. We were I saw this. My wife got it for me, and I said, "This is the coolest thing ever." And she goes, "You know, we could build these ourselves." So I said, "Well, we're gonna have to find naked people." You know, the little tiny people that are naked. Well, you would not believe what is out there. I mean, you can get...
Are you serious?
I'm serious. You get, you know, a man or a woman going at it doggy style on a couch. It's like, I know, it's unbelievable. Tons of nudes, people playing volleyball, you know, one guy, a naked guy with a camera taking pictures of other women. It's really something so stunning that I stopped doing the hobby.
No, wait a minute. Why did you stop? It was getting unsettling.
I was hurting my eyes. These things are these things are so small, and you know, to get them into an aquarium, I should say a terrarium, to make it look like there's something going on. Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, it's all out there. Everything's there. I love technology.
I feel like you're going to be.
You can find miniature nude people screwing.
Are you like, you just go on the internet and Google this and it comes up?
Yep, naked people for, I think it was for like either N-Gage train sets. And this is what really creeped me out, is that this is sold through you know, hobbyists that build train sets. So they have these trains that go through these elaborate setups going through cities and the country, and all of a sudden they're going through a nudist camp. there are some creepy, creepy hobbyists out there.
Right, I was going to say, well, this is probably, like, usually the guy that's got the train set when he's 50 is still living in his mother's basement, so I don't know if it surprised me that his only relationship to nude people are little miniature plastic figurines.
Oh, man.
Unbelievable.
Too funny.
But what's amazing to me is... in the current incarnation of the show, which is you, Tom, Chick, and Christy Lee, you've been together how many years? Is it almost 20?
Well, I think it's, for the most part, all of us have been together getting close. I mean, 28 years with the four of us.
Jesus.
And me and Tom, we just celebrated 30 years at FBQ, and it's, I think, 33 or 34 years that we've known each other in radio. So it's been a long relationship with all of us, yeah.
At 5 days a week, 4 hours a day for 30 some odd years, like, and you do it effortlessly. What, I mean, which is amazing. And you know, I read something that you said about Tom, which is the quote is, you know, we got to know each other personally rather than just on the air, and we knew each other's bad habits and established a great rapport. Like, has that been the secret to be able to get this chemistry to work?
That's just it. It's a chemistry that just happened. You know, the two of us never intended on being in radio. So we both kind of fell into radio, and then we just happened to meet each other. And during the lean years, you know, we had to room together so we could actually afford to continue doing radio. And, you know, I got to know him a little bit better, but I think it was just a total fluke, because here are two guys that, you know, hey, we, you know, love life, and all of a sudden we get to talk about it on the air. And it is just, we never planned this, and it's one of those things, I don't think you can say, okay, I'm going to take this guy and this guy, put them together and do a morning show. Well, you know, we used to screw off. I would do 10 to 2. Tom would come in and do 2 to 6. And then from noon to 2, you know, we'd screw around sharing shifts and doing comedy, and it pissed off our boss. And,
oh, wow, really?
Oh, you know, so we ended up going to a different radio station. And, you know, they kind of let us do what we wanted to do. And we just kept building our craft, and luckily we got to build it in a small town, Petoskey, Michigan. So if we, you know, if we screwed up, there was no consequence. It was all right.
Yeah, it's sort of like cable TV in the beginning. It was the same thing. I mean, the Daily Shows, like when we started out, it was, you know, Comedy Central, what it wasn't then what it is now, and the stakes weren't as high. And there was just, they let you kind of, they ordered the show and didn't put a show order limit on it. They just said, let it run and see what happens. And that's the
beauty of it. Yeah, so you, it's a chance for you guys to actually work your craft in front of an audience. And you will find out what works and what doesn't, and it just makes your show better. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's interesting that it wasn't planned, because it seems some of the best things happen that way. You were in graduate school at Cal State, right? And you were doing you were doing an internship in radio there, and like
See, I think that stuff there is I think rumor. No, I went to Cal State Long Beach and you know, doing theater.
Right.
And. No, I never did radio until 1979, I walked into a radio station, and I'd been helping with a group called the Young Americans who's doing their sound reinforcement. When they go on the road, you know, I'd mix their show, and I decided we did some summer theater in Petoskey, and I said, you know what, I really like it here. I'm going to stay.
Well, what brought you to Michigan? What brought you to Michigan?
The Young Americans did a summer theater there, and they'd put on like five musicals, and I was a tech guy, so I would do lights and sound, and it was a lot of fun, and I loved the area so much that I said, I'm staying here. So I went over to a radio station and walked in, and I asked the manager there, hey, do you need somebody to spin records for your DJs? And he said, no, we already, he goes, our DJs do that themselves. Do you want to be a DJ? I said, well, what do I have to do? And next thing you know, I'm on the air.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. It was, I just don't think that would ever happen today. But
no.
Yeah, it was a total fluke.
And you were a tech guy for the Young Americans, so you were doing all that. Plus, you probably were the guy that had to get pot for everybody, right? Because usually that's a tech guy's job.
There was that guy.
So now you start doing, and you doing overnight, so you just spin a record. And could you pick any records
you wanted? When I started, they had me doing, believe it or not, a 4 in the afternoon to midnight shift.
What?
So it was long.
8 hours.
It was long. 8 hours doing news. They heavy on the music. They really didn't want me to talk that much, but I at least got my foot in the door.
Yeah. So, and were you experimenting with little comedy bits when you had a chance to talk? And there was
And they kind of frowned on that because they wanted the music to be. It was we don't want personality. We want music.
Right.
And
right.
Sadly, a lot of people are. Heading back that way with the iPod and everything else. They just want their radio station to be like a jukebox. I think what separates radio from the iPod and everything else is personality.
Yeah.
And you gotta have it in order to you gotta have a friend talking to you instead of just your iPod playing music.
Yeah. Well, where do you think this sort of ends up going? I mean, radio has obviously been going through a lot of trials and tribulations, and, obviously with podcasts now sort of, taking some listeners away. They have these people meters now. I mean, you've been in this business so long, and you've seen it up and down. I mean, but, with these big companies owning all these radio stations, was it better when they were sort of more independently owned and there was truer competition in these markets? Or?
Oh, yeah, I'll say, yeah, I love the mom-and-pop operations much more than the big corporate stuff. But sadly, I have no say-so in it. If I want to, if I want to do a radio program, a syndicated radio program, corporate America has to step in. They just won't, no one else is going to syndicate you, so...
But you have freedom now because of the size and how long you've been around to kind of do what you want to do creatively, right? I mean,
true. I mean, I think the only thing that separates us from a podcast would be the swearing. I mean, we can do anything we like, which is nice. It took a while for us to get to that point, but it's very nice. It's great to have that freedom. A lot of people don't have that who start in radio now.
How do you develop your persona as a radio persona? Because I feel like any artist, whether it's a musician, an actor, a comedian, a radio host, you guys, like I said, 4 hours a day, you do this for so many years, you make it look easy, but it was a lot of work to go in to get to where you are to be so successful. Like, what was your persona like as an on-air guy early on in Michigan and then early on when you partnered with Tom versus kind of what it is now, or was it sort of what it is now from day one?
Well, when we started, I was the disc jockey and Tom was the news guy.
And people how you and Tom met at a bar. You were at a bar?
Yeah, a bar. I was tending bar in Michigan to supplement the income because, I was making, you ready for this? $3.50 an hour. In the big city doing radio.
Wow. You needed an agent, my friend.
Oh, that did come down the road, I will admit.
But you were probably negotiating some of your own contracts.
No, hell, you know, I was doing a radio show. Thrilled to death to even be able to step into a radio station, and it's really cool hearing your voice on the air for the very first time. There are just little things like that. But when I met Tom, he had just finished a year in Florida, was visiting his parents, and I was tending bar at night to make a little extra cash, and he goes, "Hey, can I come to the radio station and look through the trades? I'm looking for work."
Yeah.
And he came by the station the next day and got hired as my program director.
How did that? Was he a program director in Florida before that?
No, I think Tom was a really good BS artist.
What is it with you guys? I gotta go to this town. It seems like you could just walk in and go, "Hey, I want to be mayor." Okay, no problem.
Well, like, you know, I don't know why, but I don't think people. I don't know if people were actually trying to get into radio then or not, but, you know, it's just total fluke. You know, they're pulling people off the street. "Here, you want to be a disc jockey?" "Well, sure. What do I have to do?"
And so now he's program director. You're DJ at the same station.
I'm the music director. So, you know, we did a lot of stuff, figuring out music, and we got to build an AM station that played, you know, for the most part, rock. But, you know, we got to build the music, and, you know, we had to spend our own money to build the music. They weren't about to give us any cash. So we actually, you know, bought our records and put them in there and had a great time doing it. And
when you say spend your own money, you literally buying your own.
Yeah, it's like, "Oh, geez, look at this. Hey, there's Come Monday by Jimmy Buffett. All right, well, you know, I'll buy it." So I buy it. Next thing you know, it's in the rotation. You know,
able to pick your own music, right? I mean, you're not being told by anybody.
Oh, hell yeah. You go into a music store, thumb through the albums, thumb through the 45s, and if you found something cool, you know, buy it. And then I wasn't making enough money to write anything off, so it was a total loss for me.
You weren't even paying taxes. Who are you kidding? You weren't declaring anything. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey, listen, my friend. I pulled down $6,000 in 1979, and that is big dollars.
It is. Hey, did the women, did things change with women in town once you started being on air? Like, were you starting to meet women and go, "Hey, I know, I heard you."
People knew who was who, but, you know, we're in a small town, Michigan, so the minute you move to town, everybody knows who you are anyhow.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I wasn't impressing anybody, that's for sure.
Now, you were doing so much music, how were you able to sort of start, you and Tom started doing bits on the air together at that station, and then how were you able to do more bits and less music over time?
You know, I don't know, I think people just enjoyed our banter, and eventually, we would start doing recorded bits, and you'd let go of us one song so you'd get more comedy in, and eventually, a song a year was dropped until, bam, there were no more songs, and it was all comedy content and BS and comedians.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is when, you know, comedians come on, you know, people love listening to you guys. They remember your name, but, you know, we get the credit for it. "Hey, did you hear Tom this morning? Did you hear that comic this morning?" Yeah,
that was Carson's. That was Carson's theory, right? They would say, "Hey, I was like you, man. I would beg my parents to stay up to watch any comedian that was on. I just had a natural, draw to it, and that's what people would say, and that's what you guys are great at. It's like you get out of the way, you let us do our thing, you know, you help when it's just you get it. And but how is your persona developing at that time? Like were you looking and, like, you know, as a comedian, sometimes you might see what other comedians are doing, and oh, that's interesting, and you know, you get influenced a little bit by your competitors. Is it more like, I've got to keep topping myself as a radio guy, and the bits have to get more outrageous"? Like, how do you develop that persona over time? Are you consciously saying, "I'm going to be more like this, less like that"? How did that work for you guys?
Well, you know, I think it was what influenced me was, as a listener, growing up in Los Angeles, listening to the Boss Jocks on KHJ, and how they would introduce, and you know, that kind of figure, well, that's how you're supposed to do radio. So I would try to be clever in my introductions to music, or try to, you know, if something came up in the news that was funny, I mean, I would say something, and obviously was told not to tell jokes in my radio station by the program director, or the owner at the time. Mm. And but you know, it's just one of the things that if it made me laugh, I kind of figured it was going to make other people laugh.
Yeah,
I thought I was a pretty good judge of comedy.
And then sort of, you know, that relationship between you and Tom, and sort of who's steering what part of the ship when and all of that, how did that come to be, you know?
Like I said, when I first started, it was I was doing the music and you know, introducing all this stuff, and then I'd bring Tom in twice an hour to do news, and then we would BS at the end of it and try to get a you know, a funny story that would lead into a song, and we move on. And then our ratings in Michigan when we started doing the morning show at WJML, mm-hmm. they skyrocketed, and so that meant the people wanted more of me and Tom BSing together. And that's what happened. And then when we moved to Indy, it was, Tom and myself full time. It wasn't me as the disc jockey and Tom as the news guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it just built that way. And like I said, we've been honing the craft for a long time. And
yeah. Has the FCC, it seems it ebbs and flows depending on who's, you know, which party.
In charge, yeah.
Yeah, like, and was it, like, pretty free, like, in this, you know, late 70s, 80s, 90s? Like, were you able to kind of do your thing, and then it kind of...
No, we couldn't say, I mean, we had to spell out the word hell in order to use it. H-E double hockey stick was the way
we
referred to it. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, there was a... Especially being in small town America,
mm-hmm.
they didn't care for profanities on the air. But we got away with it to where we made our mascots of the radio station beavers. So we were kind of, you know, pulling the wool over their eyes. Hey,
yeah.
JML beavers are out today. Come on, let's go take a look at it. Spread the word. The beavers are out. And, you know, people loved it.
Yeah.
So it was fun little stuff that you try to get away with without, you know, it's all innuendo. It's all what you can
yeah.
create without saying something.
Yeah, we had a segment we did on The Daily Show once. It was a field piece that this guy Brian Unger did about, you know, it was the Disneyfication of Times Square. You know, they moved out all of the porn shops, and they brought in, like, you know,
right.
big corporate American. One of them was a Disney store, and he goes... And the whole premise is he goes into the Disney store and he goes, this might seem like the Disney store, but these actually are dildos. And he starts holding up, like, all the Disney
yeah.
dolls. He goes, dildo. He did it. He did it, like, a dozen
uh-huh.
times, and it all was in the piece. And then the piece aired, and the president of the network came in the next day, you know, like when you crack up the car and your father's yelling at you and all you got to do is just sit there and take it. He goes, who authorized this piece? You can't say dildo 12 times in a piece. We're like, well, what are you talking about? We didn't know there was a rule. He goes, there is a rule. I'm making a rule now. There's a sick uh-huh. dildo rule. You cannot say, what are you talking about? Like, you can't.
Who came up with that number? Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
See, that's the thing that I find, I think, with the FCC giving you the rules, and if you can break the rule without breaking the rule,
right.
That is, I think, if you can be as clever as could be, your audience, I think, loves that more than if you said, well, you know what, fuck this, fuck that, fuck this, fuck
yeah.
that, all of a sudden
yeah.
it's not exciting anymore.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's so funny you said that, because there was a comedian the other night on The Tonight Show, and basically she went on the show and goes, oh, boy, yeah. I'm a dirty comic. I'm really made more for cable, Jay. And she was like, network, you can't say fuck or cock. And then she just started saying all these words that got bleeped.
Yeah.
And it was like, really? There's no art to that at all. You're basically like a 6-year-old just saying dirty words. Like,
it's very true. But I think, you know, if you can actually say it without, you know, without actually saying it,
mm.
I think people enjoy that more than they do actually, you know, hearing the word, because it's now, I mean, it's everywhere.
Mm.
I mean, remember when the first time you heard the word shit on the air and your ears perked up and it was, oh my God, can you believe what they said?
Yeah.
Now it's on every channel, and
yeah, you become
except for ABC, CBS, and NBC, but it's everywhere else.
Have you had bits that you thought, oh, there's no way we're going to be able to do this, and you get away with it, and then other bits where you go, oh, this seems fine? Like any funny war stories of like, oh, this seems fine?
Yeah, we had a couple of them where, you know, we had this guy, this religious zealot chasing after us, trying to get us off the air many, many, many years ago. And he would record every show, have these ladies at the church type it all out in transcript, send it into the FCC every day.
Every day?
Every day.
Oh, my God.
And out of the, I think, 16,000 submissions, four were chosen as, you know, dirty. Mm. We got fined for them, and one of them was a bit called Butch Beer, about, you know, how butch women like drinking beer. And
yes,
it was totally,
man.
I thought, totally, you know, just funny. And but they had to fine us for something, and that was the worst they could find.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh
so it's obviously life has changed a great deal since then.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey,
it's always
about trying to figure out how to say it without saying it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why did you guys end up going, leaving Michigan and going to Indy and getting started there, and then you went into syndication after that? Like, how did that move come about? I think you had been sort of approached by somebody, right?
Well, we were actually, after we'd received our ratings, we had like a 44 share in the morning, which is just unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And
for people who don't know what 44 share means, that means you have 44% of the entire market listening to you at that time?
Listening to us, yeah.
Wow.
And if you look at the breakdown of the numbers in New York, for instance, a number one rated morning show in New York may have a 3.5 rating.
Jesus.
And that
you
is the... Yeah. So,
you could have told that. You could have sent out orders to that town to go riot, and they would have listened to you. That's amazing.
But here's the thing: is it wasn't us; it was our competitors who made tapes of us and sent them out to other markets, saying, "Hire these guys, get them out of here, because we are making no money." All
are you
the advertising.
Serious? Really? That's how? No. I've never heard anybody do that in competition before.
Nor had we. So our competitors would take, you know, highlights of our shows, put them all together on a cassette then, mailed it to a thing called the Superstars Convention, which was a gathering of music program directors in Miami, about 300 different stations being represented, and they played our tape in front of it to all these people. And the next thing you know, we're getting phone calls from all over the country. And we're going, what the hell? How did this happen? And
now, what do you think sparked their interest? I mean, I'm clearly there. These guys. Okay, so it's one thing to kind of win over the public. It's another thing, as you know, to win over people in the industry who do what you do. We tend to be jaded, especially, you know, people who are in power making decisions about hiring. So, what is it about? As objective as you can be, obviously you were funny, but there had to be something else that they were hearing that you guys were doing in Michigan that the cream rose to the top, if you will. What do you think it was that captured them to the point where they're calling you now? Because I'm sure they're hearing a lot of people, a lot of...
They probably are, but the thing about it, Tom and I were very good at production.
Mm-hmm.
And we could produce these bits with, you know, great effects, great music, great content, and people loved hearing that stuff. It was kind of taking it back to... It was like old Fireside Theater, or you know, theater of the mind.
Did this come from your parents, by the way? Your family? I mean, I know your dad worked for the Dodgers, but you got your brother's an actor. Where is this? Where does this DNA comes from?
I don't know. Maybe my mom's side. My grandfather was a political cartoonist for the San Francisco area papers, and I don't know. He may have had the talented gene. My dad was a great singer, but he only sang on Sunday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I don't know, I think it was just living in Los Angeles, being around the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. You that's what we wanted to be part of.
Yeah, kinda weird, and self-taught, right? I mean, all of that production value that you talked about that you and Tom were putting into those shows that ended up...
Yeah, that was, in 1972, I bought a four-track TIAC recorder that, you know, I was writing music and stuff, and I learned how to do multi-track and edit, and it was a learning experience for myself, but it also, later on, you know, like 8 years down later, turned out to be one of the best things ever. I taught myself how to edit and produce, and it was very helpful.
Yeah. So now you go over to Indy, and you start there, and are you with Chick and Christy Lee at the time, or did
No, we had a our first news gal was her name was Beth Surrett. And they hired her to do news for us, and she lasted, I don't know, about a year or so, and then probably about 2 years with her, and then they brought Christy in, and she just did news with us part-time, then she left, came back, and
she left. Kinda, what did you say to drive her off, Bob? Come on.
She fell in love and followed some dude to New Mexico.
Oh, gee. That sounds about right.
So she came back, and Chick, we found, he was hired by the AM station, which was an oldie station, and he got fired. And Tom goes, he always claims that he saved Chick from the unemployment line and hired him on the spot after he got fired down the hall. And he's been doing sports with us ever since, and he was Chuck. And we nicknamed him Chick because we had a friend of ours named Chick that came in. He brought comics in every Thursday or Friday morning. And Chick goes, man, I dig that name. I'd love to be known as Chick. And we called him Chick from that day on.
Oh, is that right? I never knew that that's how that name came about. I just thought that was the nickname that he... The band analogy for me with you guys that I have a persona, but as a comedian, but it's my persona and I don't have to really change it for anybody because it is who it is. Like, so now you're sort of, some people are coming in and out of this relationship that you and Tom have. Like, how do you sort of have to back off your persona at times? How do you make your persona work? That's an individual persona that you've now developed in a group band setting, if you will, so that the overall persona of the unit works. How do you do that? I mean, is that something you think consciously of, or you just kind of, it just,
well,
finds,
I think,
everybody finds
I don't,
their natural part?
I don't know if we actually think about that anymore. It's, we just come in and do what we do. And the key to, I think, our success is to be able, is the ability to listen and not let something go over your head. And, and the other thing is, like, we don't prepare our show together. A lot of people do, but we don't. We prepare separately. So,
why is that?
If you get a genuine laugh,
instead of a
laugh that's already been had, and then you have to come back the next day and try to recreate that laugh.
Right.
It's all natural. And
that goes to I know you guys don't really socialize on a regular basis together, and I think it's in part because you want to keep it fresh for the air, right?
Absolutely.
If you start to kind of be with each other all the time, obviously, then there's sort of a little bit of a method to the madness there for you guys.
Yeah, and we found that that's been a great part of, I think, our success was always, I would work with, my friend Whit Grayson, and Tom has...
He's a very funny guy, great writer.
Yeah, he is. And Ricky Rydell would write with Tom, and we would actually, have two separate camps, and I would write a bit with Whit, and Tom would write one with Ricky, and what you do is you sit there and produce it, next morning come on out, and hopefully you get a good, a laugh that they weren't expecting, so
yeah. And you write a lot of the songs too for the song parody, like the actual music.
Tom writes a lot of it with Steve Ali and Ricky, and I write it with Whit and Dean, and yeah, it's fun.
I think you guys are one of the originators of the idea of letting your personal life like play out on the air.
It's a soap opera that people are all tied up in, and you know, everybody. People like to know who they are, who they wake up with every morning.
Yeah, and did that start back in Michigan? And again, was that something that were you experimenting with different ways to do your show? You know, like I'll try different jokes, and no, this doesn't feel like this is in my voice. I'm more this guy. Were you sort of, or were you just sort of throwing stuff against the wall to see what sticks? Like, how did you sort of get on that formula?
I think we just tried everything. I mean, and it turned out that Tom would be the douche, and I would be the good guy. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how things just work out that way.
it's fun. It really is.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we can't do it forever. After a while, people just are not going to want to hear about how much Metamucil Tom took this morning and
how many times he cleaned his hands with hand sanitizer and what your favorite size boob is, right?
Sure. Oh, well, you can't go wrong with boobs, that's for sure.
No, you can't go wrong with boobs. You've got the thing in your house that you turn the nipple and the door opens.
That's right. It's the magic nipple.
He has a magic nipple, everybody, where you turn the nipple and it's like James Bond, and a door opens.
Into my studio. When we built the house, it's like I said, you know what? I think since we're building a house, we can do whatever we want. So I said, you know what? I've always wanted a secret door, kind of like Batman had.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And you go in. And it's a bunch of miniature naked people all sitting in his studio.
All sitting
really
on a couch,
creepy.
Just waiting for you to show up.
Getting humped.
Come on, put us in position.
Is your first love music in the sense, like, if I know you played professionally in some bands, like, talk about that a little bit and what that was like, and your heart is so based. I mean, talk about the musicians you've had on the show, because you're all, from Dean Metcalf, your producer, to, behind and in front of the camera, the microphone, a lot of music people in your world on the show and in your personal life. Your wife is a great professional singer. Your first love? Is that where your heart would be?
I've always loved music. And, Dean Metcalf, our producer, is one of the finest guitar players around, and he's also a great bass player. And he's part of a bluegrass trio that go out and play, and they're wonderful. My wife is a studio singer, and she has just completed an album with two of her friends.
Amazing voice, a lovely woman. Again, when I see her, I'm like, why are you with Bob? The same
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I know.
Say
and
about my wife.
I keep saying, why are you hitting on my wife? And
my hand. And then I say, wait, my hands aren't supposed to be here? Okay, sorry. I thought that's why God made that.
Music is very important to us. It really is. It's always been a part of our life. And music makes people happy.
Yeah,
and
did you think about
music makes people happier, I think. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's the art that you guys have that I can't get my head around is the ability to make music, but then make it and be funny with it. It's amazing. Did you think about being a musician professionally, like for real? I mean, I know you were in some bands. What was that like?
Oh yeah. Heck yeah. Every young man's dreams would be a rock star. I mean, hell yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I took it seriously. Wanted to be a rock and roller and get paid for it. Go on the road.
What was the band that you were in that was like, hey, this one might click and go? Was there one that you were was pretty serious and?
No, well, the one that that we considered serious, it was just called Catch, CATCH, and it was we were writing our own stuff and doing our own thing, and then that didn't work, so ended up just doing cover bands and playing at bars and. Mm. And having a lot of fun drinking beer and playing rock and roll.
Yeah. What was it like early on, like in the rate, like was, you know, you're single, you're in radio, and now you're sort of becoming bigger and bigger in Michigan and then in Indy, and then like, was it just a crazy party scene, like in terms of like, you know, or were you guys, you know, kind of, you know, pretty much on the fringe of that? Or, because I know that it was a go-go era of like, you know, late 70s, 80s, 90s, people partying, mm-hmm. go. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, we did our share of it in the 80s when we first arrived in Indy. That, man, we were doing promotion. We'd be at a bar promotion till 2 in the morning and then have to be on the air at 6. And it's, I mean, it wore out. It wore us out the first couple of years. But eventually we just said, hey, we cannot do these late night gigs anymore. It's killing us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we were definitely part of the party. If we, you know, if we said, hey, there was a party, you know, the whole city showed up.
Yeah. No, I can imagine. Right. Cause you got the reach and you guys went into syndication in,
1995.
Right. And yeah, how did that come about?
Well, it was, you know, we would put two albums out every year of, the highlights of the show and new songs that we'd written and stuff like that. And it turned out that radio stations all around the country were, you know, getting these CDs and playing them on the air. And there's a couple of guys, a couple of famous guys, one famous guy in Chicago, I won't give his name, but he took one of our bits and re-recorded it and called it his own.
Wow.
And we just realized that we were voted the most stolen from show in America. And honestly, and so our boss at the time, our owner, Frank Wood, Bo Wood, said, hey, let's, why don't we just syndicate you guys? That way they, you know, people can't steal from you.
Yeah.
And so it started with, I think, Evansville, Indiana, and now it's a, now it's all over the country.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I've been on the Bob and Tom tour, and they come out, the legions of fans is unbelievable, and really nice fans, and they get it, and they really respect comedy. And did you, I mean, as you're developing and getting bigger in syndication, I know you don't do it now, but early on, were you looking at competition and saying, geez, what are they doing? Maybe we should be more this way, or be, you know, is it temptation to try to top yourself and be more and more outrageous so you don't lose your fans?
This is the one thing about morning radio, probably the same thing with morning television and whatever. When you're on the air 6 to 10 or 5 to 9 and your competition's on, you know, you don't listen to them. You're on the air doing your thing and
but you're aware of them and what they. You mean you're aware of who they are?
Oh yeah, there's probably a handful of guys that I've heard of that, but honestly, never listened to their stuff.
Right. So there's never been this temptation to kind of look over your shoulder a little bit and see what the other guys are doing and making sure that you're staying on the cutting edge or any. You are obviously, but like I'm just curious about the creative process and how it changes over time for you, if it does at all, and if you've like ever thought to yourself.
No, we just change with the times and pay attention to what's going on in the world and world affairs and whatever's going on. I mean, that's what you pay attention to because that's what everybody else is paying attention
to. Yeah.
If you have, floor wax and douche face down the street doing one thing, you're not. We don't hear them, and honestly, don't care.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that since you guys are never shock jocks, you don't sign that pact with the devil. Because what I've heard and I go on some of these shows and what some of these guys say is there is this compulsion to have to feel like you have to keep topping yourself to keep, you know, because your listeners are comparing the last stunt you did. The stunt you just did with the last one you just did, and if it's not as outrageous, you know, to the point where you run out of room, right? Like it's like, oh, okay, well, I got to really entertain people, so I'm going to drop a baby into a well. This, you know what I mean? Like it's like it starts to get crazy, and you never have to deal with that because you obviously never were those kind of guys.
No, and sadly, we still we get labeled as shock jocks, where in fact we aren't. I mean, we're just...
I don't see that at all. I mean, really.
Oh, I know, but it had that label, followed us around for a while, and which just wasn't true. But to, your average churchgoer who doesn't listen to the radio, we are.
Right.
And, you know how people are. You know, if somebody says, well, you know, these people are evil, and now you have this a group of people who say this man is evil, even though this group of people has never heard the program.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the lemmings following over the cliff. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, sure.
And do you have, in terms of, with the family, with friends, like when you play stuff out on the air, have you ever gotten in trouble? Have you ever gone home or had somebody call and say, what the fuck were you thinking talking about that? Like, or have you ever like in the middle of something on there going, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said
no,
that.
I don't think that's ever happened.
Really?
Uh-huh,
wow.
Really.
You have a
I
good
don't think
barometer.
That has ever happened.
Jesus, man, you have a good barometer, man. That's good. I would have stuck my foot in my mouth a million times by now. Good
well,
for you.
Yeah, I've even seen you stick it in your mouth, and I haven't known you that long. Jesus Christ, Paul. Everybody knows you do it.
Yeah, I know. I'm a bit of an ass when it comes to that shit.
You know what? You're a man out looking for a fight, and you don't even know it.
Yeah, that's true.
Uh-huh.
I have my incidents, as we know. We've talked about it on the air.
You have a tendency to get into a little hot water here and there.
But
and
I
you,
do
you know,
think
you end up in the paper and arrested, you know, stuff like that. I come home to a lovely bride, and we just relax and play with the dogs.
That's it. Play with your naked miniature people. I want to see
right.
these miniature people when I come to town.
I will gladly show them to you. In fact, I'll even I'll pick a set out for you to take home.
give it to my son Alex. It'll be a good.
Here, Alex. This is how babies are made.
Hey, what's this thing I hear? You got an RV now, and you're going to go around the country camping. I hear you've got. You got a new
car. Well, we're trying to be a little adventuresome, so we got us a little RV. We mainly got it so we could tailgate at NFL games.
I was going to say, because I don't see you in the woods. I see you being frightened and then...
Well, believe it or not, I was quite the camper as a young man.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yeah. Our family used to go camping all the time. You'd jump in the old... jump in the car, take your tent with you, go into the wilds of California and... You know, help cook on a Coleman. That's what it was all about.
Yeah, that's true. I used to do that as a Boy Scout, and that was a lot of fun. But I see you more as like if you could set up in the woods, you would have like a 62-inch plasma screen TV.
No,
right
they're 19-inch. 19-inch. They're small. It's a small van, but it does have a satellite. And also, we've purchased a Jeep Wrangler, so we're going to do some off-roading.
Nice.
Be part of the Jeep Jamborees that go on around America.
What is that?
Oh, yeah, we're getting into four-wheeling and having some adventures outdoors.
Are you going to like start packing some heat and going out with a gun and all that stuff?
I already pack heat.
and you know
who you don't want to mess with? My wife. She's a dead-eye a shot.
Is she really?
She is. Oh, yeah.
I didn't know. Becky shoots? I didn't know that.
Oh. Well, you ready for this? When Becky was a little girl, her family, her dad, made bullets.
Made bullets?
Yes.
What, did she live in the 1800s? Who makes bullets? Little House on the Prairie?
I tell you, the next time you talk to her, you can talk bullets for hours. Her and her brothers used to, pour the lead and do the whole thing. I mean, she's from a whole line of gun people.
Wait, did she grow up in Indy? Where did she grow up?
Illinois.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh.
And how did you guys meet? Did you meet through the music thing on the
show?
Yeah,
she was singer. She was a singer, and I fell in love with my backup singer. And,
great voice. She
oh,
a great
yeah.
Great voice.
And great taste in men.
Oh, my God. Listen, she's got the better of that deal, all right? I've seen you naked, and I can say, wait a minute, that wasn't...
Wait a minute, when was that?
You were asleep.
No, I see. Okay. Just lifted the cover because you wanted to see if all the rumors were true, huh? Okay.
And you know what? They were. You will never go back, people. You will never go
back. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Listen, Tell me about the whiskey thing. I hear, like, I see Bob Kevoyan. I just so people know, when I see Bob Kevoyan, I see a man with a very handsome, sexy, rugged mustache, your L.A. Dodgers cap, and a can of beer in your hand. But now I'm hearing something different. What's going on?
All right, here's what happened. As you know, I like playing golf.
Yes.
And through the years...
Well, we got to play golf together when I come next time. We never played golf together yet.
Do you throw clubs? Are you a club thrower? Huh? Are you a club thrower?
I will argue with people, but maybe a little bit. No. Why would you think I would throw clubs?
Well, you know, anyone who gets in an argument with a guy who runs a newsstand probably throws clubs.
I do actually, but not. I'll keep it under control for you.
All right. So I love the game of golf, and through golf you meet a lot of wonderful people, and. Turns out, through syndication, a lot of people listen to your program who you have no idea listen to you.
Right.
And one of these people is great guitarist Vince Gill.
Mm.
So I've become friends with Vince, and he has invited me to come play in his golf tournament, the Vinny, which has been going on for years. It raises a lot of money for the youth of Tennessee. And they have this auction to help raise money the night before the tournament. And one of the items was a barrel of Jack Daniel's whiskey.
Wow.
And no one, you know, they got a guy up there auctioning off, no one's bidding on it. So I figured, well, here's what I'll do is I'll make the first bid, and then people will start bidding, and, you know, I'll bid it up, which I've been known to do in the past.
Yes.
To raise more money for the kids. Well, I was the only one to bid on it. So I got a barrel of whiskey.
Really?
Yes, a full barrel. So Becky and I had to drive to Lynchburg, Tennessee, and pick out our barrel. And we went through the whole tour, and at the end of the tour, we sit down with one of the distillers, and we taste three different barrels, the whiskey from three different barrels. And we
no, it's the
barrel.
Same whiskey. It's not like the Honey Jack. It's all the same. It's basically
no, it's
Jack
all the same. All the same.
I
exactly.
love Jack Daniels, by the way. I'm a Jack Daniels.
Oh, it's delicious. And I wasn't a real whiskey drinker until I bought a barrel. Which
you were a pussy. I know, but now you're a man.
But now it's straight. It's Jack Daniels on the rocks. Nothing else. Don't bruise it with Coke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh huh. So
you try these three barrels, and can
so
you tell the difference?
We pick our barrel. And the good folks at Jack Daniels bottle it, put your name on it, and ship it to you. And there's a thing called the Angel Share. Each barrel has a different amount depending on how it's, you know, how long it's fermented. And, and our barrel produced 286 bottles of whiskey.
What?
So
you have 286 bottles of whiskey in your house?
Well, yes, that's what how it started. We gave away a lot at Christmas time.
Oh,
and by the way, for being a guest on today's program, Paul, you get a bottle of whiskey.
All right. I got to be a guest on my show more often.
See how great it is?
This is awesome. So I'll come, we'll drink whiskey, and we'll play golf, and and then we'll hang out in the nude and tan. And
I'll just tan with you. I don't want to do the nude thing with you. There's something, you're starting to creep me out a little bit.
Well, it's the whole nude miniature thing that got me going. Hey, any guests that you've had that, like, blew you away, like you couldn't believe you got them, or a guest, funny story about a guest that, I'm sure, like, just you wanted to wring their neck and get rid of them, or you did, or anything that's happened that you...
You know, the bad guests, you'll wipe from your memory. And, you know what, I there's just not room to their memory inside.
Yeah.
The great guests, you know, there's so many.
You've had the Allman Brothers on, right? You've had the Allman Brothers?
Yeah, we had Greg Allman on. Tom happened to the bathroom when Greg Allman was in there, and they're both standing at the urinal whizzing, and Greg Allman turns to him and goes, "Boy, you don't get much time to boogie getting up this early in the morning, do you?" And he's like, no. I mean, you know, and we're surprised that Greg Allman actually made it to the show that early in the morning. But
yeah,
we've met a lot of great people. The highlight to me, though, is I got to interview Paul McCartney when he came through on tour, and I was the only one who got the interview. No one else did. It wasn't a big press conference. I was invited to come interview him, and so I went backstage at Banker's Life and sat with me and McCartney, and it was great.
Unbelievable.
And the thing about it is I many years before, Chick was in California with Jimmy Mad Dog Matus, doing a thing for Miller Lite, and one of the guests was going to be Paul McCartney. And, you know, we're on the air, and Tom goes, "Bob, you got to go out there." I said, "Okay." He goes, "But if you go out there, you only have to do one thing, and that's get your picture taken with Paul McCartney." I said, "Okay, well, I'll go." So I fly out there, don't tell anybody I'm leaving, and I get there at and George Lopez is a young comic at the time, a friend of ours. Mm-hmm. And George goes, "Hey, can you get me into this thing?" I said, "Well, I don't know, George. We need the press pass and everything else." And I said, "Well, just follow me and maybe we can get one." And we just sneak George in. They don't ask for a pass or not. He sneaks in. He's part of the thing when we're, you know, the press conference. And at the I'm sitting down in the second row. They leave the front row empty. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the press conference, Paul McCartney says, "All right, let's do a little picky with Paul." Yeah. He sits down in the front row, and everyone squeezes behind him. And I jump over to the front row and sit down and say, "Hi, Paul." Bob comes in and goes, "Hello, Bob. Have a seat." And I get my picture taken with Paul McCartney.
Oh,
10 years later, I take that picture with me when I interview McCartney and have him sign it.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's one of those cool things I have hanging in my office.
That's amazing. Yeah. And is that the picture? Do you use that for your Twitter picture, too? Or I've seen that.
The Twitter picture is the picture of when I interviewed him one-on-one.
Wow. And how is it that you got to interview him one-on-one and no one else did?
I have no idea. All of a sudden, I got a phone call from our PD at the time, and he goes, "Do you want to interview him?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "All right, well, be at the arena at such and such a time." And I, you know, whipped us back after soundcheck and sat down and talked with him. And
yeah,
it was pretty damn cool.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I met him briefly at the Colbert Report. He did the show.
A
couple of weeks, and he couldn't have been nicer. And the whole time I'm talking to him, I'm looking at his face, and I'm like, "I'm talking to Paul McCartney on the inside."
I know, on the inside, I know. You're screaming like a little girl. I know.
It's like, "He looks so great. Oh, my God. Is he really 70? Like,
Say you wanted to see him naked, too, Paul? I'm curious.
I said, "Are you into miniature people naked? Because come with me, my friend." Listen, this has been great. I can't thank you enough for doing this. And I just want to say that the show is unique, obviously, because of the talent you guys have on the air. But the way you embrace guests like myself, even somebody as creepy as me, has been amazing. And I think it's fair to say, obviously, the show's successful because of the four of you on the air. But I just everybody on the show reflects you and Tom and the way you guys run the show. You know, everybody's great. Everybody's generous. Everybody's really creative and always been great to me. And I just want to acknowledge, like, this Dean Metcalf is your producer, amazing. Joni Downing does all the booking. Jason Hofstadt's a producer. Matt Thompson does your website, great guy. Scott Fenstermaker, the big man engineer, great guy. PJ Yinger and Drew Carey and of course Ron Sexton, who's Donnie Baker. Like, all those people make that
show. Yeah, there's like, and Steve Salgi, who does a number of voices and does, in my opinion, the best Bill Clinton ever.
He does the Bill Clinton, right? If I'm leaving anybody out, please mention it. But I hope you don't mind. But I just want people to know that there's all these amazing people behind the scenes that make that thing run too.
Oh, there are. We're fortunate to be surrounded by such talented people, and you know, it reflects in the program, I think. So.
Yeah, and that they've been all been with you for a long time, especially you, considering how unsettling you are as a human being, is pretty amazing.
It's amazing. You know, people see me and they cringe. It's I thought it was the Elephant Man for a long time, and then I realized it wasn't me at all. It was the fact that I knew Paul Mercurio.
And with that, I'm going to say thank you, my friend. Love you. You're the best. And thanks for doing this. And I'm looking forward to the whiskey.
Yeah. Get your ass over here. It's there's a bottle with your name on it.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks,
we'll talk
Paul.
To you soon.
Okay.
Have a
good
day.
Bye.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.